From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the state of California's water supply after a couple of dry years and a stormy couple of weeks. Also, singer-songwriter Ricky Berger. But first, what are the prospects for the huge planned redevelopment of Cal Expo? It's the latest attempt to build a replacement for ARCO Arena and, not incidentally, rebuild the state fairground site and construct housing, offices and other commercial space. The previous attempt to fund a new arena failed in 2006 at the ballot box. The National Basketball Association then got involved because of its desire to see the Sacramento Kings play at a newer and better facility. Coming up, we'll talk with the head of Cal Expo and a local elected official who's long been skeptical of public involvement in the building of professional sports facilities. But first, the NBA's representative in this matter. He's John Moog, a Baltimore-based financial advisor to the sports and entertainment industries. John Moog, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeff. It's good to be here.
What are the chances, do you think, that this plan will be built?
Well, we're not going to know that until we go out to the private sector and ask them. And we're not obviously going to be able to do that in this financial environment. We're going to have to wait till things clear up. But this is one of the first times in the history of the sport, certainly, where we are trying to rely almost entirely on the private sector to finance a project through monetizing the land at Cal Expo. But again, we're not going to know until we actually go out and ask.
Well, let me put it another way. What would happen if this plan is not built?
Well, we would then have to look at Plan B, wherever Plan B might be.
Sounds like there is no Plan B then.
There is not a Plan B currently. That's correct.
How much did you look at other sites? This plan is solely focused on the Cal Expo area, but other sites have been talked about over the years as possible places for a new arena.
Yeah, we looked at a number of sites. We started with the rail yards because that's where the early focus was and spent actually a tremendous amount of time trying to figure out if we could make that work. We looked at Sutter County. We looked at Sac State. We looked at downtown until we finally came across Cal Expo, which, of course, has a tremendous amount of land that sits vacant through large parts of the year and doesn't contribute to the tax base. And it's a wonderful, wonderful site, well managed by Norb Bartosik, who unfortunately has his hands tied because he doesn't have the ability to improve its infrastructure and make much needed repairs. So we thought we found a partnership that just might work for both of us.
Were any of those other sites a close second?
They really weren't. I mean, if anything, I will say that we did try very hard to see if there was anything at the rail yards that could work. We just couldn't come up with any way to monetize that property in a way that would rely on private dollars as opposed to tax dollars.
Some people say, why not just build a new arena at Natomas? Because all the land is currently owned. There are two freeways intersecting there. Presumably all the basic infrastructure is in place. Why not just raise less money to build another arena there?
Because we can't find a way to raise enough money to do it. The property there actually is underwater right now in terms of the bonds that are owed on it. So the property doesn't currently have much value. And so by trying to do the project we're trying to do at Cal Expo, it becomes infeasible because of the number of acres and the value proposition just is not what we can get out of Cal Expo if this works. And again, this is a project that is going to require first and foremost the repair of Cal Expo and delivering them a state-of-the-art facility, and then a new arena, which will be a fabulous partner, of course, to Cal Expo, who will be able to use it as well. But we could not make that work in Natomas, even though we obviously tried.
I'm talking with John Moog, the NBA's representative in negotiations with Cal Expo on a proposed redevelopment plan for the state fairground site that would include a new arena. When the NBA's commissioner, David Stern, hired you to handle this big challenge, what exactly did he say he wanted?
He wanted me to get it done, which a lot easier said than done, I think. But, you know, the commissioner is committed to Sacramento, and it's pretty impressive, I think, because while other people may be more inclined to throw up their hands, he said, look, we're going to put some time and money into this and see if we can't make it work. Sacramento has been fabulous town for the NBA. It's some of the strongest fans I've seen, matter of fact, across the country. Maybe Green Bay has a little bit of an edge on you, but not much. And I think the commissioner recognized that, felt that we owed the town our help in doing what we can to figure out if there's a way to make this work, make sure that there's an arena always in Sacramento for not only sporting events, but for the arts and family shows. And so that's what we're all about.
In our studio is Norb Bartosik, CEO and General Manager of Cal Expo. Norb, welcome back to Inside.
Happy to be back.
Did Cal Expo approach John Moog when you heard what he'd been assigned to do?
Actually, no. John gave us a call and said he'd like to come visit with us and talk about the possibilities and to see if there was any interest on our part. And so we set up an initial meeting, and he and I and a couple staff met with him and talked through the process.
Why can't Cal Expo just go through a simpler mechanism to refurbish its own facilities, which is fair to say are old and now modest?
Well, and that's a really good question. The reality of it is that because we are a state agency and because we have many of the issues that relate to government controls and things, we don't have the ability to monetize the land by bonding up on the value of it. And it has a significant amount of value because it's a large parcel of property. So we could do the process of fixing the fairgrounds, but it would take numerous bond issues and a long time to do it because the construction that would take place would have to also include business interruptions and those kinds of things that normally you have to take a part in. So this was a plan that when it got discussed and talked out further seemed to make a lot more sense because it created a synergy between us, Cal Expo, and the NBA, and an ability to recreate something that was considered at one point going to be the Disneyland of the North. And so all that got together and it seemed to make some sense.
If this plan happens, then the huge sprawling Cal Expo site would be completely rebuilt. And the actual state fairgrounds portion would be a relatively small part of the current footprint. There'd be an arena with an NBA team presumably there, lots of housing, offices. Is Cal Expo concerned that the state fairgrounds become the tail of the dog if this redevelopment were to go ahead?
Actually, I think we're still in the leadership position in terms of the property, the facility. We still own all of the land. The reality of it is that it would get us to a point quicker than we could ever do on our own in reality. And I think that if as John mentioned previously, if there are developers that can come to the table and say this plan works and here's what we'd like to work with you on, I think that's how we would perceive it. And I just think that a lot of it made a lot of sense.
John Moog, have you actually talked with any developers who might be interested and have the ability to handle a development of this size?
We did. You know, we've had two economic studies done, one by ERA, which the NBA engaged. We took that study and ran that by a number of major national developers. Now, granted, this is before the market crash. And they examined the numbers and the assumptions, and they felt that it was indeed a realistic project. And obviously gave us great solace. Now, obviously, the world has changed. And the only good thing about that is that it gives us time to do the things we need to do to entitle a property, et cetera, to make it attractive enough to the private sector so that it's able to fund the kind of improvement Norb's needs and a new arena and what would effectively be a very, very neat village, obviously a village that would be built out over time, but a place where people could live and walk to work and walk to their entertainment and parks and exercise facilities, et cetera.
Best case scenario, what would be the earliest that an arena could be built?
Oh, best case, probably not until 4 years from now.
Norb, does that sound right to you?
Yeah, 4 to 5 years, I think he's right.
And what about the state fairgrounds?
Well, it would be done at the same time. That's the whole first phase of it, would be to do a project that would take in the development of the parcel of property that would include the arena and the fairground relocation onto a new parcel within the parcel.
So the earliest would be 4 years for a new arena. John Moog, what have the Maloofs said to you about that, the owners of the Sacramento Kings and the Sacramento Marks, who would be the highest profile users of this new arena, we hear unofficially that they're losing many millions of dollars a year. Have they said that they'd be willing to stick around that long?
I think the issue, Jeffrey, is there light at the end of the tunnel? And that is how the commissioner has tried to frame it and discuss it with the Maloofs, that obviously we're not going to be able to deliver an arena for you in a couple years here. This is a proposition that takes a while. And obviously their patience is being tested because it's costing them a lot of money to be patient. So I understand their feeling, but the goal is to, again, get to something that looks like it's doable in the foreseeable future. If we can get there, I think we keep the Kings in Sacramento.
Does this proposal depend on the Sacramento Kings staying in Sacramento?
I'm sorry, does what?
Does this proposal depend upon the Kings staying in Sacramento? In other words, if the Maloofs were to move the Kings to another city in the meantime, would this proposal fall apart?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. John Moog is the NBA's representative in negotiations with CalExpo on a proposed redevelopment plan for the state fairground site, including a new arena. In our studio, Norb Bartosik, who is heads CalExpo. On the phone, Dave Jones, California Assemblyman. He's an ex officio member of the CalExpo board. He was, as you might recall, a leader of the opposition to the attempt a couple of years ago to build an arena in Sacramento, largely with public money. Assemblyman Jones, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey.
You did not think much of the arena plans, specifically the funding plans in 2006. What do you make of this plan?
My problem in 2006 was that the lion's share of the funding for the arena was going to come from taxpayer dollars, specifically a tax increase. As to the land use plan that we saw for the first time last week, I think it's a good plan. I think that a more urban infill sort of development in that area makes a lot of sense for a whole host of reasons. I think the big question that remains unanswered and why it makes sense to go out to the development community is what does it cost to build the entire project, and is there enough revenue coming off of the land development to cover the cost not only of the retail and residential and office and other elements of the development, but also to pay for an arena and fair improvements. And I think that's the big unanswered question at this point.
What's your gut feeling? Do you get the sense that, at least in theory, pencils out for now?
Well, we had two sets of consultants speak to the board last week. The consultant that was hired by CalExpo at the request of the Department of General Services, Gruen & Gruen, had differences with the NBA consultants in terms of some of the assumptions underlying the economic analysis and some of the financial implications of those assumptions. And so I think there are still some big questions about whether it does or does not pencil out. One of the things that I asked about specifically was what will be the owner's contribution, because I think that's a very important question. And also I thought it important to make sure that people understood that one of the proposals on the table is the possibility of relying on some of the revenues that would otherwise flow from taxes on the new developed property to local governments. And so I just think it's important that this proposal be as transparent as possible so that the public and decision makers know what's being considered.
John Moog, can you address some of those issues? Let's start with any contribution from the Maloof family.
Yeah, I think when I addressed the CalExpo board last week, I said this project, in my estimation, is going to rely upon three different things. One is obviously very, very significant contribution from the developer to the capital expenditure cost of the property. Two, the property, I believe, is going to need assistance in the form of tax incremental financing, and that's a financing that has been used for redevelopment zones in California. That would probably require state legislation.
Excuse me, John, just so people understand, you're talking there, I think, about basically borrowing money on the basis of expected increased revenues from higher property taxes because of all this development.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. The property does not generate any taxes right now as state property. It would generate a significant amount of taxes, so you would borrow against some of that income to do your infrastructure. And then the third, to address Mr. Jones's point, is that, yes, the Maloose would absolutely have to contribute to the arena, and they have acknowledged that.
Would you expect any public funds to directly come out of some form of local or state government, out of their general funds or something along those lines, to pay for any of this or any associated costs?
No, we wouldn't. And when we came into Sacramento the first time 2.5 years ago now, I think we came in with the presumption that simply was not feasible, and we're not even going to waste our time on that.
Assemblyman Jones, quick response to what you just heard there from John Moog.
Well, I think they've been very consistent about new tax dollars in the form of raising additional taxes. Where I think, though, that decision makers are going to have to make a decision downstream is on the tax increment financing, because that does have an impact. I mean, essentially, there will be additional city and county and services required to service the new residential, commercial, and office and hotel development. You'll need police officers and firefighters and code enforcement officers and so on, and those all cost the city and county money. And if the entirety of the property tax revenue stream coming out of that development is used to help build the arena, then the local governments don't have that money, and then it raises a question of how do they cover those costs. So I think that's a question that needs to be addressed and answered downstream. I don't think we know precisely what level of tax increment financing will be necessary, what the developer contribution will be, or for that matter, what the owner's contribution will be. But I do think it's an important question, particularly at a time when city and county budgets are cratering right now. I mean, we're actually seeing cities and counties lay off law enforcement personnel and others because of budget problems. But at this juncture, I do think it makes sense to reach out to the development community and see, you know, what their response is, and whether in fact it's possible to generate enough revenue off of this thing to fund the arena and the fairgrounds. But I think we need to be mindful that there is a potential impact to city and county general funds as well.
John Moog, just very quickly, if there were to be road, highway, public transportation upgrades to accommodate all the extra traffic in the area, how would that be paid for?
Well, we have not gotten into the traffic studies. It's clear just anecdotally that obviously there needs to be some improvement done with or without a new arena on the site. The commissioner has said that he would move the games so that it doesn't conflict with rush hour, but that really doesn't answer the question of what has to be done there, again, with or without an arena. That bridge obviously needs to be widened at some point in time. In our discussions with the Sacramento area county of governments, Mike McKeever suggested to us that we look at really increasing the density on the site. One of the reasons he suggests that is that you do create much more of an urban atmosphere that then justifies additional transit coming into the site in the form of light rail or trolleys or whatever. So our plan actually has grown in size to accommodate that purpose or that need, mm-hmm. if you will, since our first go-round.
And Norb Bartosik, finally for you, how important is this project to Cal Expo, and specifically, what would happen to Cal Expo if the plan were to fall through?
Well, Cal Expo will continue to operate in the way it does now and look for creative and alternative methods to continue to maintain and upkeep the facilities. The plan that was presented has lots of synergy. And I think the key focus is being able to, as everyone has agreed, see if there's the development community is out there that can find ways to support it. Now, as John has mentioned earlier, and the assemblyman as well, the economy is where it's at right now. I think the word that we all use with this is proceed cautiously and try to determine what the next best steps are. And the first is putting together an RFQ, which is a request for qualifications, and then bring those folks in and talk about what the next steps are from there.
Well, thank you so much. In our studio, Norb Bartosik, CEO and General Manager of Cal Expo. On the phone, John Moog, who's representing the National Basketball Association in talks with Cal Expo on a proposed redevelopment plan for the state fairground site, including a new sports and entertainment arena. And Assemblyman Dave Jones, who represents the area in the state assembly. He's also an ex officio member of the Cal Expo board. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the state of California's water supply after a couple of dry years and a stormy couple of weeks. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with something you heard on Insight? Tell us what it was and why at insight@capradio.org. It's been stormy recently, but seasonal rainfall is still below average, and this follows two other dry winters. So government agencies in California are planning for worsening drought. Last week, Governor Schwarzenegger declared a state drought emergency. Many Sacramento area water customers have been asked to reduce water consumption. And federal water managers recently told California farmers their supply could be temporarily shut off. We're going to check in now with a couple of water officials and experts to find out more of what's going on. We'll also talk with a National Weather Service meteorologist. But we start with Wendy Martin, statewide drought manager for the California Department of Water Resources. Wendy, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
How serious a water problem does California face this year?
California's water situation is still very dire. And the reason that I say that, and I know it's been a difficult message to get out there in the face of all of these storms, which we are very thankful for, by the way, is that with the two preceding dry years, we drew down our surface and groundwater storage supplies dangerously low. And so the storms that have come recently have done a lot to saturate the ground and begin to start recovering those lost reserves, but we have a long ways to go before they're full.
What will happen if there isn't significant refilling of the reservoirs in the months that follow?
Well, you know, our hope is we have a pretty good snowpack right now. It's up nearing what we would expect for average this time of year, and we hope that those reservoirs continue to increase. But California's drought is more than just the hydrology. We also have a very serious water supply problem, and that means that even if we had an average year and we were able to get some of our reservoirs up to, you know, pretty decent levels, there still is difficulty in delivering water through the system. We still have an increased level of uncertainty about our weather patterns, and I'm sure you'll hear a little bit more about that as a result of climate change. We don't know what the future holds in store, and we don't know if this is the third year of a three-year drought or the third year of a 10-year drought.
But increasing capacity, particularly reservoirs, is very controversial politically. There are many people in the environmental movement and their allies who say that reservoirs are just too destructive and expensive, and the state just needs to use less water.
Well, I think we can make areas of improvement all the way around. We know that we can do more in conservation, and that has to be part of the portfolio. Usually when people are expressing concerns about new storage, it's related to surface storage or reservoirs above the ground. There's a lot that can be done with groundwater storage, and that's been a big focus of the department. And those projects seem to be somewhat less controversial because we're not building new large infrastructure projects on the surface of the land, rather using groundwater basins to move water back into the existing aquifers in the ground.
When the governor declared a drought state of emergency recently, there are a whole lot of things flow from that. But correct me if I'm wrong, I don't see any required belt tightening yet when it comes to water consumption. Is that right?
Well, what the governor has done is ask all Californians for extreme conservation. You may remember earlier this year, the governor put out an objective that he wanted all Californians to reduce their water use 20% by the year 2020. Well, he's changed that. He's asking all Californians to reduce their water use today by 20%. And so he also, in his proclamation, acknowledged that if conditions continue to decline or if people don't respond, that he may consider more severe constraints.
What are the consequences, though, here? What can the governor do at this point to actually make people use less water? It's one thing for the governor to ask people to use less water, but what consequences are there for people who fail to cut their water consumption?
Well, I think, you know, as in land use decisions, most water management happens at the local level. So there are incentives that can be provided to local agencies in the form of funding or assistance that would encourage them to do the conservation that's needed. Conversely, if they don't, those resources may not be available to them. It's never in the history of the state has the governor ever imposed statewide mandatory conservation, and that's a very challenging undertaking. But we have a governor who's willing to consider it.
Wendy Martin is statewide drought manager for the California Department of Water Resources. Let's talk with someone who's closer to the customers, Michael Carlin, Assistant General Manager of Water at the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Michael, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
How does the drought, the current state of water supplies, and the current amount of demand in California look to a water agency like yours?
Well, it varies. You know, California is just not one climatological region. There's different climates. There's different water use patterns. There's different rainfall patterns. And so you have to take that into consideration when you look at how it affects different people in different parts of the state. I will say that basically this is a third dry year. It's something that, as local managers, we started planning or responding to actually 2 years ago when we started asking our customers to do 10% voluntary conservation, which they have achieved for the past 2 years and continue to achieve today in this third year.
How receptive do you think they will be to the governor's request that they reduce their water consumption by 20%?
Well, I think that's a challenge that the governor has issued to all Californians to reduce their water usage, and we're going to look at ways that we can maintain the 12% reduction we've already achieved in our service area and see if there are other ways to achieve even greater reductions in the future.
Give us a couple of examples of how you are trying to reduce demand and increase supply.
And that's really good because it really is a hand-in-glove sort of issue. So some of the things that we're doing is we're accelerating some of our recycled water plans in our service area, looking at how we can substitute imported surface water with recycled water. As Wendy mentioned, we have a conjunctive use project where we're using a groundwater basin and surface water, excess surface water, in conjunction with each other to extend our supply. We also have a pilot desalinization plant that we're running with four other major water agencies in the Bay Area and looking at that to extend our supplies. And then finally, conservation. And that's a real key thing here is we continue to push conservation devices. We continue to push the conservation message out into the community. And we tend to get really good response because people not only see it as basically saving water, saving the environment, but they're also saving money.
A couple of weeks ago, I got an email out of the blue from one of our listeners who just said to me, since we're low on water in California, I was thinking that there's plenty of water to go around in the ocean. Perhaps if we can somehow use seawater to replenish our water supply, we could kill two birds with one stone, end of quote. And I got back to that listener saying, well, desalination or desalinization, as it's also known, my understanding is it tends to take an enormous amount of energy to produce drinkable water. You did mention desalination or desalinization. What are the arguments for and against it?
Well, the arguments for it is basically, you know, we're surrounded by water in general, you know, here in San Francisco on three sides by the Pacific Ocean and San Francisco Bay. There are a lot of places along San Francisco Bay where, you know, the water is saline but not usable, obviously. So do we have access to the water? Yes. What does it take to actually produce, you know, drinkable water? It takes a lot of energy, and is that energy really worth it to produce, you know, a gallon of water from San Francisco Bay or the Pacific Ocean? There's also environmental concerns, basically, on, you know, what comes in with the water. Then also you have this reject salt that you have to get rid of, and where does that go? So there's a number of environmental issues. There's a number of energy issues. And are there other things that are more cost-effective to do rather than build desalinization plants?
Wendy Martin, does the state of California have a position on this?
I think, you know, what we're starting to see as water becomes a more pricey commodity to secure, as communities, particularly in times of shortage, need to go looking to buy water, either surface water or groundwater, that the prices of water, the demand for water is driving the price of water up. And that starts to make desalination a more attractive part of the portfolio. At the Department of Water Resources, we believe that you have to have a variety of tools in the toolbox, and that desalination is one of those tools. Certainly, there are places in the world where they have been very effective at desalting water for drinking water, but those also tend to be the places that have lots of energy supplies as well.
The Middle East, particularly.
The Middle East, particularly, yes. But that being said, I think the technology is going to continue to evolve, and there are sustainable forms of energy that may be able to be used to help with the energy to desalt water. We certainly want to keep moving in that direction, okay, because we think it's going to be an important tool.
Finally, Wendy, what will it take for the state to move to the next point and require reduced water use?
Well, you know, that's a very challenging question, and I don't know the answer to it. But I suspect that if Mother Nature helps us out this year and we continue to get some precipitation and our reservoirs continue to fill, that it's unlikely we would go to mandatory conservation this year. I do believe we have to have aggressive voluntary conservation, and there are ways that we can incentivize that for people without being heavy-handed. We want people to take those steps, and we know that there are other places in the world where citizens lead high-quality lives using much less water.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much. Wendy Martin, statewide drought manager for the California Department of Water Resources. Michael Carlin, assistant general manager of water at the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
On the phone now is Brooke Bingaman, who's a National Weather Service meteorologist in Sacramento. Brooke, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Can't hear you too well, so you might want to speak up a little bit. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Brooke, what kind of rainfall have we seen so far this winter in Northern California?
What kind of rainfall have we seen?
Yes. What kind of quantity of rainfall compared to what we would normally expect?
Well, what we've seen so far for this water year, and first I'll preface this by saying our water year does not match a calendar year. Our water year begins July 1st. So since July 1st, we have seen 12.99 inches of rain, which is about 85% of normal. Typically, this time of year, we would have about 15.25 inches of rain.
I see. What kind of impact have the recent storms had on the amount of rainfall in this rain season?
Well, the recent storms have definitely helped us out with the dry winters that California have been experiencing. January was actually extremely dry. We were only 68% normal at the beginning of January, and then because of the dry weather pattern, we dropped down to 56% of normal. But then February came in, and we had some good storms in February. We went from being 56% of normal up to 76% of normal. And the month of February, we actually had over 5 inches of rain, which is over an inch more than we typically get for February. In the month of March, we only had 4 days of March, but it's definitely come in like a lion with the recent winter storms that we've had. And in just 4 days, we've gone from being 79% of normal to 85% of normal of what we would typically expect in a winter rain year.
Was all this rainfall in recent weeks a surprise to meteorologists, or did you all see it coming?
So we definitely were open 24/7, and we're constantly monitoring the weather. So this wasn't a surprise all of a sudden rain started falling from the sky. We definitely saw these storms developing. For our winter storms, they typically develop in the Gulf of Alaska. So we start to see the indications of that forming, and then we watch them on satellite as they move into the California and West coastline.
And finally, Brooke, what's the weather outlook for Northern California?
Well, the weather outlook for the next week, we are actually going back into a dry pattern. We may get some lingering showers continuing tonight up in the mountains and the higher terrain areas of Northern California. But for the valley portions, we're actually going to be seeing drier weather in the upcoming week. Now, that's not to say that we won't have additional winter storms, because January, February, and March are typically our wettest months for Northern California. So there's still the possibility, since March isn't over, we'll hopefully get additional winter storms.
Okay. Brooke Bingaman, National Weather Service meteorologist in Sacramento, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the music of Ricky Berger. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to capradio.org/insight for links, images, and information about our topics and guests. Sacramento singer-songwriter Ricky Berger's music is a kind of jazzy, bluesy folk, a sound in keeping with her throwback look. And she's a versatile musician. Her instruments include piano, ukulele, and accordion. She's in concert tomorrow night in Sacramento and Saturday night in Chico. We met Ricky on Insight last summer around the time of her debut release called Ricky Berger's first album. She spoke with guest host David Watts Barton.
Ricky Berger, welcome to Insight.
Hi.
Next big thing, huh?
Oh, yeah. I guess.
People have very strong reactions to you. They really, really love your stuff.
I can't believe it. I'm so lucky. It makes me feel so happy that I can connect with people. I don't know. I have the best job ever.
Great. Well, before we talk anymore, people know what we're talking about. Let's hear one of your songs. What are you going to play?
Okay, the song is the first song on my album. It's called If, and there's a cool music video for it, too. If the sun refuses to rise while there's still the night, if the moon forget she hasn't got the time to come out after 9. There's still the light in the stars, and the stars are in your eyes, in your eyes, in your eyes, in your eyes, in your eyes. If the grass stops growing, well, I'll make friends with the cement. And it's hard and it's cold, but I guess I'll just get over it. Because it's soft, it's loving, and there's warmth within your heart. In your heart, in your heart, in your heart, in your heart. If there's a God and I die, well, I hope I go to heaven. He damns me down south. Well, I'll go down happy, knowing at least I had the chance to kiss your mouth, 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 kiss your mouth. And there is nothing, no, nothing to keep me from you. And there is nothing. Nothing for you I wouldn't do. If the sun goes down, if the moon forgets, well, there's still the light in the stars, and the stars are in your eyes, in your eyes, in your eyes, in your eyes. Yes, there's the light in the stars, and the stars are in your eyes, in your eyes.
Ricky Berger, that's If from her first album, Ricky Berger's first album.
Yep.
Clever title. Yeah. People often say that your music seems timeless. What do you think they're saying when they say that? How does that work?
I don't know. That makes me feel really good. I actually definitely try for that. I think it's really important that music's able to communicate to all people of all different ages. And I don't know. I have a lot of older friends, so if it's timeless, that's a good thing. It means it can connect with everyone. Mm-hmm. So,
Did you you grew up in Bakersfield?
Uh-huh.
Did you didn't grow up listening to country music? I'm not hearing much twang in your music.
I know a lot of people think that's weird. No, I guess I didn't really grow up listening to a lot of country. The only country I ever really grew up with was my dad really liked Dolly Parton, and I do too as well. But no, not much. But I did go to the Buck Owens Crystal Palace a couple times.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I saw him a couple times. He was great.
What did you listen to growing up?
I don't know. Let's see. I guess I listened to a lot of classical music when I was younger, and I just recently kind of got into jazz music maybe a couple years ago. And, you know, what's weird is I really like cartoon music. I know that sounds really odd, but I have some tapes and CDs like the Merry Melodies, mm-hmm. kind of stuff. It's like hilarious to listen to. I like that kind of stuff. It's silly and fun. So, and I like a lot of like classical guitar, the LAGQ and, they're really amazing. So,
mm-hmm. Well, what inspired you to start playing?
Oh, I don't know. I've been playing piano since I was four. And I don't know. I always wrote songs. I didn't think I was going to be a performer. I just thought I was going to write songs for other people. And I kind of just fell into it and caught the bug. So, yeah, I just thought I was going to write songs for other people and they could, you know, mm-hmm. take care of the good stuff.
Do you ever write songs like that particular song, If? Did you write that with anybody else in mind? Or did you write songs thinking, oh, this would be great for
No, actually, I never got that far. I never quite got there, but no, I like that song. It's the first song that my mom ever really liked. And so it's always, like, you know, been special to me. So, and she was the one that told me I should title it If. So.
Oh, huh.
Yeah. So there you are.
And I'm not sure exactly what that song's about. It sounds like it's possibly saying goodbye to somebody or...
Actually, it's... I wrote it a couple of years ago, and it was about my boyfriend at the time, and it was a long-distance relationship. I actually had just moved to Sacramento, and he still lived in Bakersfield. Mm. And so actually it was kind of about, you know, things are tough, but let's look on the bright side and... you know, that kind of mm-hmm. thing, having a positive attitude. So,
and what I read somewhere that you were appalled that someone thought you were insincere in your music, or that you.
Oh no, they I think what you're talking about is probably Tim from the Midtown Monthly. He just asked if I guess there's a lot of songwriters that write things just because they want to write about a certain topic or mm-hmm. something. And he asked if I do that. I was just surprised. I don't think I would know how to do that. I can only write about, you know, what I can write about. It's just pretty much love. That's kind of what I know the best.
That seems a fairly safe subject in songs.
Everybody can, you know, connect with that, and that's good. It's, you know, what I know mostly. I'm only 20. How much, you know, how much can I know thus far, you know?
Right.
So.
Well, let's hear another song from the album.
Okay. This is the last track. So we have the first, and we'll have the last track. The song is called Silly Boy Goodnight.
Ricky Burger.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Tell him goodbye. He prays that I will change my mind. So he stays, and I say goodnight. He chases, and I put up a fight. He takes up so much of my precious time. I shake my head for the third time, and he stays, and I say goodnight. Say no to you, who? So if you got the blues, go run on to someone who loves you.
And you can beg, and you will still be denied. And you can plead, and I won't be at your side. Cause I made up my tired mind. It's like I told you, silly boy, good night. Silly boy, good night. Silly boy, good night.
Very nice.
Thanks.
So you have been listening to jazz.
Yeah. Yeah.
Older jazz, too. That's.
Yeah, I love older jazz, actually, because it's so sincere sounding and sentimental. I like that.
Mm-hmm. So. And you also play the ukulele?
I do play the ukulele. I play a lot of instruments. I'm kind of an instrument junkie, I guess. Mm-hmm. I play I play piano and flute, guitar, ukulele, accordion. See what else? Saxophone. I really want to play the harp. I think that would be really great. And cello.
This one?
Yes. Not the mouth harp. Yeah, I love pedal harps in orchestras and stuff. Oh, mm-hmm. They're so pretty. I love how that sounds. So that'd be really cool.
Does the instrument you're playing really affect the song that you write? Do you write that song was written on guitar? Because I could hear that song played on ukulele. It would sound somewhat different, but it would have the same feel, right?
I never really thought about that. I guess I don't think very much. I just feel.
You just do it.
You know, I just feel it out and just whatnot. I don't know. I don't ever have an instrument in mind. I just. To feel like playing one and pick it up and say, okay, let's write a song on this one. And, just put out whatever I'm feeling at the moment. Mm-hmm. So,
I'm speaking with Ricky Berger. When you were talking about recording the album, I read that you recorded 53 songs for the album. Is that that you wrote 53 songs for the album?
Yeah, I did a lot of recording. This has been a long process.
That's a lot of recording. That's 5 albums worth of material.
I should have actually released this album about 6 months ago. I was just so nervous. I was so scared, people wouldn't like me or something. So I was too nervous to release it. And I finally just grew up and said, you know what? I'm going to put it out there. So.
And how did you choose out of those 53 songs? How did you choose 11 songs, I think, for the album?
I guess there wasn't really a process or anything. I just kind of... was making a list and whatnot, and I just said, oh, I want this song on there, I want this one on. I think it was kind of a, there's a period of time that I wrote those, and so it was like a growth period. Mm-hmm. So I felt like having them together.
I also read that you were going to probably go a little bit more jazz direction with the next release.
Yeah, it's a little jazzier, and I can't wait. There's some really cool stuff, some celesta and... there actually will be some harp and string sections and stuff. I like things simple, but it'll be a little more orchestrated, so it'll be really pretty.
Yeah, it's a very simple album. I mean, what you just played is not far off from how the album sounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like to keep things pretty. Well, I like to keep it about as real as it is, live. Mm-hmm. I don't want my audience to get confused,
On the other hand, I also read that you were thinking about, or I think it was on your MySpace page, you were talking about putting a rock and roll band together.
What? No, I never said that.
Wasn't that you? You sure?
No, yes.
A little, you not ready to shred a little bit on getting an electric guitar?
No.
Do you play electric guitar?
Actually, I started on electric guitar, oddly enough. I had a Fender Stratocaster, and I just found it in the closet at my house. That's how I started playing guitar. But everybody thought it was so weird. I don't ask me to play with a pick. It's terrible. I'm not very good with one. I'm just a finger picker. And mm-hmm. people are like, you need to get an acoustic guitar. You're playing really weird stuff on this electric. And so, yeah, it was odd. I didn't even plug it in. It's terrible.
you can play them without a pick, too.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you can. It just... Just trust me, it's bad.
Okay, well, I don't think I would be surprised by anything that you put on one of your albums at this point. There's a lot there. Ricky Berger, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been wonderful.
Ricky Berger on Insight last July with David Watts Barton. Her upcoming concerts include Sacramento's Fox and Goose tomorrow evening and Cafe Coda in Chico on Saturday. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Nathan Wilkinson, Rebecca Nelson, and Lynn Weaver. Today's engineer was Evan Matzler. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us.